Okay. We shall embark upon our last session of the day. Let me get another one of these out, and I think I'll pour myself some water. Thank you for your hospitality, and you've been a wonderful group of people to speak to. I've enjoyed immensely interacting with some of you during the breaks. During the break, one of the values of breaks is it raises various questions, and a question was raised during the break. Have we ever fought through the gender issue before? It's like I said, you know, slavery has been defeated once, and abortion was defeated once in this country. A little known fact, which you can find, there's, by the way, a wonderful, you can, I think, find this online, a little journal that used to be put out called Christian History. And I found it, that's where I found this, a wonderful little article on this topic. Gives a good deal of factual basis for it. But the gender issue, and the question came up is, has this ever been fought out before? Well, yes, it has, and it's like everything else we've named. It's been defeated once, and now it's come back. And you can see every time these things come back, they come back in reaction to what the church has already done. You can see this with abortion. Abortion has returned as a vehemently anti-Christian stance, a vehemently anti-Christian wedge, if you will. And what we're facing now, what we're seeing everywhere, as, by the way, let me just recommend, any of you ever heard of Miriam Grossman? Ever heard of her? Let me recommend her. Her books are easily available as downloads if you have a Kindle, or you can buy them. She was a psychiatrist who was on staff at UCLA in the Student Medical Health Center. And over the years, as a counselor and a psychiatrist on staff, she's an Orthodox Jew. But she became so appalled and horrified at all the things she was hearing, and particularly at the destruction that she was seeing in young girls' lives who have bought all the lines, that she finally wrote a book that is a real smasher, if you will, and essentially more or less told the truth. And she initially wrote it anonymously because she was afraid. She was fearful that if she really spoke her mind on this issue, that she would face vehement, more than opposition, she would face persecution, because everything is so politically incorrect. But the point of her several books, one of them is called You're Teaching My Child What? And it's kind of an expose of the sex education world. And I'm trying to remember the title of the other book, which I don't remember offhand. Yes, exactly. Have you read? You've read her. You've seen. Yes, I'm Protected. And the point of it, and I hope I can be a little bit explicit. Can I be a little explicit here? Okay. The point of it is, of course, the answer to everything is condoms. And she was dealing with a girl whose heart was broken and who had various medical issues arise in her life, and she said, well, I followed all the rules, and we always use those things. She said, unfortunately, there's no such thing as a condom for the heart. Good point. That kind of human wreckage she had seen so much of. In other words, yeah, you're being protected, you bet. No, you're unprotected. All of our youth are now unprotected because we've decided that we know better than what our traditions, and all of our traditions, of course, were Christian traditions, our Jewish traditions, taught us, and we're now reaping the whirlwind. Was not, and look at the marriage issue. it's not that many years ago, I first started to notice. I mean, I just looked out there and I saw, you know, the goal anymore is not to get married, establish a family, have children. The goal now is to shack up and have dogs.
It's true.
The amount of cohabitation is just appalling. And, of course, the rationale is always, well, you should drive the car a little before you buy it. There have been a lot of studies done on cohabitation. There's not a single one that shows it does anything but damage. Because, in fact, it's not a matter of, once you're involved on that level, you lose all discernment anyway. One of the first things Miriam Grossman points out in her book on Protected, you know what oxytocin is? Well, ladies, do you know what oxytocin is? It's a hormone that you have that men don't. You become physically, intimately involved, and all of a sudden this hormone is released in you that bonds you to whoever it is. Guys don't have it. So guess who gets taken advantage of? You know, here you're making out with somebody who's a killer soldier for the mafia, and you think he's the most wonderful human being on the face of the earth because you've suddenly been flooded with this hormone. There's a reason grandma told you not to kiss on the first date. And she wasn't wrong. Now that's just the beginning, and that's about the first of 100 good facts or 1,000 good facts that Miriam Grossman points out. And she's, as a medical doctor, she's given her life to this. She's really terrific, and I would recommend her books. But all of these issues, the gender issue, has it been fought through before? Well, yeah, it has. It's actually why there's a gender issue. In one sense, and it's only in one sense, was there a gender issue in the ancient world? And the answer mostly is no. Everywhere in the ancient world, with a few notable exceptions, people were completely polysexual. And it probably didn't just stop with the human species. I mean, wherever, however you could find gratification was just fine. Now, have there always been men and women? Well, yes, and as another book that we should all at least be acquainted with is a book called The Inevitability of Patriarchy by someone named Steven Goldberg. I think Goldberg used to be, I think he might, maybe it was at Harvard. And this book was written, it's a 35-year-old book, but it was written at the height of what was radical feminism in those days. And Goldberg, who's got a mind like, it's like ice logic, ka-chink, 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 ka-chink. Margaret Mead read Stephen Goldberg, and she said, he's nailed it. He's got it right. It's just as you talk about a clear thinker. And Goldberg's basic point in The Inevitability of Patriarchy is it doesn't matter what culture you look at in the history of the world, without exception, they are controlled by men. What he means by that is if you want to take a head count of who's in charge, 100% of all societies in the history of the world have been controlled by men. Now, if you look at slavery, maybe 50% of, I don't even know if it's 50%, but maybe we'll just say 50% of all societies have been slave societies, 50% haven't. That means there's some, if you will, looseness in whether or not your society is going to be a slave society or not. But patriarchy, in terms of that definition, 100%. That means something. You think you're going to create a world that's, in that sense, run by women? Good luck. The reason that 100% of all cultures, if you take a head count as to who's in charge, are men, is because of hormones. What male hormones produce is different from what female hormones produce. And by the way, if you think this means that women are somehow expendable, well, good luck to that. Who do you think makes life bearable? Who do you think makes life in the first place? But in terms of power, just sheer power, male hormones produce something different. They produce a kind of dominance that female hormones do not. Last night we had on, what was it, Hawaii 5-0. And you see these, you see these female detectives who act like Clint Eastwood. I'm sorry, that isn't life. You know, they've got 5 black belts and they're out there killing each other with karate. That isn't life. Men maybe do that. But I don't know, you think you're going to get hordes of women who are on the Hawaii 5-0 squad who are going out there killing bad guys with their bare hands? It doesn't happen that way. And if you create a world where you have expectation that it will happen that way, all you're doing is setting people up for the most horrific sort of clashes in their mind. Somehow life doesn't happen that way. So, yes, there are inevitabilities in the world, and they're built into us, and they're biological. At the very lowest, they're biological, and you're not gonna get away from that. All right, just a simple point. But now, my point here was the ancient world. Did the ancient world have a gender issue? Well, the ancient world was run by men. The modern world is run by men. The world will always, in this sense, be run by men. But everybody knows in every home who the boss is. See, you just have different kinds of power. Am I not correct? I mean, we all make jokes. Every joke in the world is a gender joke. Because everybody knows it's true. Everybody knows it's true. This doesn't mean you just have different kinds of power. But in terms of dominant social power, of course, the ancient world was run by men. But on the deeper question, we say, was there a gender question? Was there a gender issue? Well, the whole of the ancient world was essentially polysexual. And you do have some major exceptions to that. Really, the one great major exception to that would have been who?
The Sadducees.
Pardon?
Israel?
Yes, the Jews. The Jews. And you see, and now I know Jim has been here a lot. And I suspect that he has taught when he's been here on what does he call it? The covenant that comes to us after the collapse of Israel. What's he call that?
The Oikumen
covenant, you could call it that. After Israel loses the land and Israel goes into captivity.
The restoration covenant,
that's what he calls it, yeah. Yeah, Jim he's fabulous on this, and I really don't know of anybody else who's developed it in this way. It's unique, and it's really, really illuminating when you see it this way. Did Israel decline after she lost her nationhood and went into captivity? Actually, Israel vastly increased in authority, power, and influence worldwide. Why? Well, you see the whole model of it in the book of Daniel. Every place wanted to have, and you know this hasn't changed. Who is it that President Nixon has for an advisor?
Kissinger.
I mean, Jews are still the advisors everywhere in the world. But everybody wanted the Daniel. So Daniel goes off, he becomes the head advisor to Nebuchadnezzar. Actually becomes, if you will, the shadow prime minister of all of Babylon. And we don't even know all the places where that happened. What you see in the book of Daniel is something like a preliminary picture of what happened everywhere. The Jews spread everywhere. They became very influential. They took their law with them. They took their God with them. And we cannot trace how much influence they actually had. It's impossible to trace. There is one very simple way to determine the power of the Jews, and that's to look at a world where we are reasonably certain there weren't any. That would have been the world that the Spaniards, particularly the Spaniards and the Portuguese, discovered after their great explorations, the New World, Central America and South America, and you have gigantic empires, the Incas and the Aztecs, and this is a world without Jews. What did it look like?
Everywhere.
When the Spaniards went there, they said, oh, we know about this. We've read about it in our Bible. You're just Canaanites. You're civilizations of sex and death. That's all you are. And they bred whole tribes of people for no other purpose except human sacrifice. That's why the Spaniards could defeat them, because all those tribal peoples joined them. You know, about 75 Spaniards and then hordes of tribal, and they drove them into the sea and they defeated them. It's an amazing story. One of the great stories of world history. The Spaniards defeating these enormous empires with almost nothing, single-handedly. Well, that was a world without Jews. The world that you see that does have Jews, and those Jews go everywhere, they take their law with them, they take their influence with them, and they take their God with them. And those nations actually begin to become different. Now, I couldn't prove this, but I have a very good friend in Boulder who is a classicist. He teaches at the university. He's been there for 40 years. He's a Missouri Synod Lutheran. He's a very serious Christian. And he agrees with me on this. He says, yeah, this is very difficult to trace the lines, but he says, I think it's true. I do not think that there is any real explanation for the emergence of Roman jurisprudence, for example, or Greek philosophy, apart from the effects of the Jews. And that's not to say that Greek philosophy is something that we should incorporate and say is the most wonderful. It is to say that there's a level of development here that's not explicable in terms of pure nature religion, in which you have everywhere that you go that is pure paganism, that has never been influenced by the Jews, you have nothing but pure nature religion. Wherever you have nature religion, you don't have rules of evidence to prove that there's such a thing as guilt or innocence. Now, what you have are things like trial by fire, trial by drowning. You have witch hunts. You don't have what we would call a real legal system. The Romans developed an extraordinary system of jurisprudence that essentially was based on the idea of justice. The idea of justice does not arise from nature. Where did they get that? I think the only real conceivable explanation is the Jews became a hidden influence all over what became the Roman Republic and then the Roman Empire. The same is true with Greek philosophy. An idea, an abstract idea of reason, does not develop out of nature religions. It's impossible. It doesn't arise out of nature. It arises from somewhere else. So you get an Aristotelian or a Platonic view of an abstract good or an abstract rationality. That's a, if you will, that is a shadow, maybe even a kind of autoimmune response. It is a kind of response or reaction to the God of the Jews. I don't think there's any other explanation. The same is true of all sexual conduct. The ancient world was polysexual. There is one especially extraordinary exception to that. Do you know where that would have been? That despised homosexuality. The Roman Republic. I don't know of another exception to that in the ancient world. The Roman Republic. When the Roman Republic ceased to be the Republic, became the Empire, then you see the return of all of these behaviors. And you see a collapse into polysexualism all over again. Well, then with the rise of the Christian faith, what you begin to see is differentiation that begins to grow up. Once again, the idea that, see, the Christian faith moved from the collapse of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was a very high civilization. For example, just to give you an example of how high a civilization it was, if you just want to count in terms of miles, the amount of paved road in the world, you do not equal the amount of paved road, which would have by and large been rock, you know, would have been, what do you call it, cobblestone, that sort of thing, or there were certain kinds of pavement. You don't have as much paved road in the world as you had at the time of Caesar Augustus until the 19th century. That is the extent, the waterworks of the Roman Empire, you can hardly believe. They had hot baths everywhere, all the way up into where we would now call Belgium. These cities had running water, running sewers, hot baths. All of that collapsed and fell apart. Well, with that collapse and the return of tribalism and the barbarians took over again and the tribes took over again, and then the very slow conversion of those tribes and the development of monarchies and the development of proto-nations and then the development of nations, which was a very slow process, more than 1,000 years that took, you begin to get sexual differentiation again. And up to that time, all these people were polysexual. Now, what you begin to get, you do not have a distinct group of people that we would call homosexual, or you could call the queer class, or there'd be a number of names that these would be their own self-appointed names, until about the time of Oscar Wilde in the 19th century. And the reason, it's only about 200 years ago that you begin to get a distinct group of people who identify themselves as being homosexual. And before that, the world was essentially polysexual. Really, what the Reformation did a great deal up to the time of the Reformation, you see marriage is essentially a matter of estates and property. It's a legal matter. This is how you propagate children this way, and you have to have children so you can have, partly you have children so you can have labor. See, increasingly, this is why, one reason we don't have huge families anymore, because people used to have huge families because they became laborers. Now, children are an expense. Then they're actually capital, if you will. It's a reversal in how we view families. But at the time of the Reformation, and I think Luther's marriage is one of the most important relationships in the history of the world, even though Luther was a thoroughly medieval man himself, he began to create a new kind of mentality about marriage. And as C.S. Lewis says, it's C.S. Lewis's own remark in his History of English Literature, he says it is the Puritans who began, the Calvinists and the Puritans in particular, who began to develop the notion of companionate marriage. If any of you have read, what is her name, Marriage to a Difficult Man, I can't remember the author, the lady author of the book, but it's the story of the marriage of Jonathan Edwards to Sarah Pierpont, his wife. One of the most extraordinary marriages in the history of the world. A great love story. And they produced this brood that went on for generations of people who became everything from vice presidents of the United States to presidents of universities and hordes of missionaries and clergymen. What they produced out of their family was simply extraordinary. And it came from this companionate marriage of Jonathan and Sarah. That would be, I mean, not all Puritan marriages were that extraordinary, but the Puritans developed this notion of companionate marriage. You marry, it's a relationship, it's love, and you're deeply devoted. It's not just a matter of estates and money and producing children who are labor. It's much beyond, far beyond that. Well, with this, what you see in the Reformation is a kind of individuation. You begin to see what you find the gospel does wherever it goes is it narrows things down and defines them more. Narrows things down and defines them more. So you find the human race moves from complete polysexualism to certainly Christian families. And in Christian families, it began to be the case that the father began to lead devotions in his family and so on, to something more defined than that in the Reformation. You could put it this way if you wanted to say it in a negative way. What is it that created the queer class? High Protestantism. because it was in reaction to this. Men and women became differentiated, and companionate marriage, it became much more defined, much more, if you will, colorful. It was highly, much more highly developed than it had ever been in the whole history of the world. And you see, the whole model of this is the bride of Christ, is the church. The bride of the bride of Jesus Christ himself is the church. That becomes the ultimate model. So, of course, this becomes one of the highest things in the world. Well, in reaction to that, this also becomes, I thought I wrote it up here, the 200 years ago, the queer class becomes its own differentiated group and becomes self-defined in reaction. So in a certain sense, you see, the question is, and we're still living this out. I mean, what began 200 years ago with people like Oscar Wilde, you know the story of Oscar Wilde, he eventually went to jail. Actually, the appearance is he got converted in jail before his death, went back to the Roman church. Yes, was it defeated once before? Yes. It was defeated in the initial differentiation of the world into men and women by, if you will, the image of the bride of Christ and the law of the Jews, which carried through with the Christians. What Paul says in Romans chapter 1 is unique in the ancient world. Nobody else would have thought of that. Nobody. Romans chapter 1 is unique in the ancient world. Well, then, after it's defeated, it grows up again, but in a far more differentiated and defined sense. So, if you will, this, for the first time in the ancient world, is just sort of sinful humanity as a mass. Now, it's something that is defined as something being explicitly anti-Christian. So it takes on, if you will, a more militant character, as all things do that begin to define themselves as being explicitly anti-Christian. And this does. And that's where we're at now. Yes?
Can you give me a definition of polysexual?
I'm reluctant to.
Poly means several or many?
Yeah, it means you have sex with anything. There you go.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, you use it in the entire ancient world. You just have sex with anybody, but it's...
Anything.
Anything.
Yeah, bestiality, which is, you have laws against bestiality as well as gender laws in the book, in the Old Testament. So in other words, the Christian, the Jews to initially, and then the Christians... That the sexual act is confined to the covenant of marriage. Now that is a discipline that the human race is simply incapable of outside of the grace of God. And it was very slow in actually asserting itself into Christian civilization. Is that helpful?
Well, in terms of your presentation, I mean, all of the world, that's a lot of time up to the establishment of Israel and saying it was all polysexual, that sex could be gratified with anybody or anything. I just have never had a picture of this.
Well, it may not. Look, there are ups and downs with anything. And yeah, it's true that I'm sure you find in the ancient world, there would have been some sort of general revelation, and people either responded or reacted to that. But generally speaking, and I guess that's how I should broaden it a little. More generally speaking, the human race was more or less polysexual through all that time. Yeah, it is the revelation of God that has changed that. There's substantially nothing else that stands in the way of it.
But the revelation of God was there from the beginning.
Yeah, that's right. And there's going to be a certain degree of either response or reaction to that. However, that's why special revelation is necessary, because general revelation doesn't produce much. It tends to produce more reaction than it does response. it's special revelation that brings special grace now maybe there is maybe. See, I'm of the opinion. You ask the question, well, who's saved? You know, I don't know. You know, I'm reluctant to. If somebody explicitly says, "Yes, I spit in the face of Jesus Christ," well, that's pretty clear. But what, you know, the old question: what about the tribal person out in the desert of the steppe lands of Australia? See, and I tend to think, because I don't think we really know how this works. But if there's response, you go out in the desert and say, "Help!" And you don't even quite know who you're saying help to. You're probably in. I mean, God's standard is much lower when there's not a lot of special revelation, and there's still probably the possibility of real response to something. And we don't know how much people have responded or not. But we do know that most civilizations, yes, polysexuality would have been very broad in the human race. And that would have been true right into medieval Europe. Yes?
We're seeing that really in our country where the Supreme Court is going to have to deal with the issue of marriage soon. And once you, if you knock down the wall of one man and one woman, well.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, what's wrong with polygamy? What's wrong? Exactly. If you want to marry your horse, how are they going to say no? It's really true.
It's true.
Now where this is all in reaction to the Christian faith. It's been defeated once. See, I think this is the general rule. Everything gets defeated once when it's still sort of a undifferentiated pagan mindset. And you can have an undifferentiated pagan mindset about certain issues far into the history of a civilization. And it gets defeated once, the church defeats it, but then it comes back as an autoimmune disease. See, why is the gay issue back? Well, you're nice Christian people, you're supposed to be against discrimination. You can't be bigots. See, I mean, all the Christian rhetoric that we would have used around the racial issue, of course, is now being used around this, so it's an autoimmune response. The very thing that first gave us immunity to it as a disease is now coming back as an autoimmune response and reasserting itself. So it has to be defeated all over again. And the question that we have is, how do we deal with autoimmune disease? See, that's the real missionary question, yes. Yeah, the Bible, of course, says two things. It says, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." It also says, "The spiritual man judges all things."
Right, and they don't remember that. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Yes.
If I can bring us back to, you made a point that the Hebrews likely had a lot of influence on these various ancient cultures. Well, we find evidence of that in Scripture itself, in the second book of Maccabees, where Judas, one of the Maccabees, one of the brothers, has a back and forth in mail with the Spartans at the time, who are called the Laodiceans. And the Laodiceans said, we are brothers, we go back in history because we are also the seed of Abraham. And you also see something similar in letters between the Maccabees and the Roman Empire prior to the Romans occupying Israel. So I just wanted to lend a little bit of extra credibility to what you said.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thank you for that. Reading the Apocrypha shed some light on this.
Sure.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Gosh, I left out all kinds of things I was going to say, and it's too late to start with them. How much time do I? It's almost 3 o'clock. All right, let me take a little more time. I want to close with this, and this, I think, gives us a direction to move. And I know that the limit of attention has something to do with the limit of how long one can be seated. So I will try to respect that, and I make this pretty short. But I want to close on a note of where do we go? What's something we can actually do? How can we function as Christians? And I hope we've gotten some kind of clue about, you know, what you're doing here with community ministry is really important. And you're really, I think, on the right wavelength. And getting to know other Christians in your community is really important. And that's really where you want to be. I think you're going down a whole bunch of the right roads, good roads. I want to close with this. I want to close with the nature of sin, but even beyond that, the nature of original sin. So what's original sin? Somebody just tell me. You all know what original sin is. Somebody just give me some. Yes. Go ahead. Okay. Yeah.
I guess it depends east and west. In the west, they have a bit of a different understanding of it. My understanding is that in the west, the idea is that original sin is when, of course, Adam and Eve sinned. And it is something that essentially, I would almost say genetically, passes through the entire human race as a consequence of that breaking of, I guess we would say, fellowship with God. And I guess the only difference between East and West is an issue of guilt. As I understand it, in the East they teach that we are not guilty, certainly, of Adam and Eve's sin, but we're only guilty of our own. Whereas in the West, Augustine particularly, we all share in Adam's guilt. Was that
accurate? Yeah. Augustine's not as popular in the East as he is in the West. not much like. I was thinking more, you could do either East or West for what I'm going to do, but I'm thinking more in terms of a Western view. And what I want to look at here are to show you again that there is creedal growth or development. Every era applies the whole of the Bible to all of life. But every era has different problems and issues it has to deal with. And that means that various things get emphasized. Now, the way that we have dealt with original sin is that, curiously, the very thing that is viewed as the highest virtue in any given culture, the Christian church has generally taken and said, that's the essence of original sin. The very thing that culture thinks is the highest virtue, the church has said that very thing is the essence of original sin. So, if we look at what St. Augustine said, what did St. Augustine say was the essence of original sin? Anybody remember? Pride. I want to be like God. I want to be God. I want to exalt myself to the position of God. Does anybody know what Aristotle said in his Ethics was the best man? The magnificent man. And the Roman view, the Roman view is kind of a balancing act. You want to be magnificent and huge, and what you really want to be is admired. The ideal is to be a magnificent man who practices largesse. I might go out, I have a litter, I have a chair that is carried by the more slaves, the better. It shows I'm more powerful and magnificent. So I'm carried out by 6-8 slaves, and then I throw gold coins to the masses. And everybody admires me. Now, St. Augustine pointed out that, curiously, you cannot build a community on that basis. If everybody wants to be admired by everybody else, there's nobody left, and there's no community. And Augustine ended up saying that pride, or the magnificent man, far from being the highest virtue, is actually the worst sin. It's the very essence of original sin. Now, you come to Anselm. Anselm would have said that the essence of original sin would be something rather similar, viewing myself as honorable, the most honorable. I want to be the most honorable of all. When you get to Luther and the Reformation, I actually don't know of any place that Luther actually states this, what the essence of original sin is. But if I put all of Luther together, the very essence of Luther is, if I am a monk and I want to make myself worthy before God, how do I do it? That's right, you hate yourself, you debase you. I might take a whip and beat myself up. So the very essence of, if you will, if I'm a monastic in that era, and you have corrupt monasticism, the highest good might be something like self-hatred. If I just hate myself enough and beat myself up, God will accept me. And Luther said, no, that's actually, in a curious sense, it's backwards. That's the essence of original sin. That's a kind of pride. Yeah. So for Luther said that faith, of course, Luther faithless, famously believed in justification by faith, said, no, believing that Jesus Christ is my atonement and that he accepts me and loves me is the opposite of original sin. Okay? So belief becomes the essence of it. We now live in a, we've lived for the last 150 years in a capitalist society, or a society that's made up of workers. Americans are amongst the busiest people on earth. The Chinese and Koreans are maybe even busier than we are. Dickens satirized this kind of man in someone like Scrooge. Now, Karl Barth, who was a German, he's got a magnificent, wonderful whole thing on original sin, and he redefines original sin. He says, here's what Augustine said, but I want to give it another twist. Here's what I want to say about it. Anybody know what Karl Barth said was the essence of original sin? He said the essence of original sin is sloth. However, what he meant by sloth, we think of sloth, that's when, oh, I can't even get out of bed this morning. All I'm going to do is watch soap operas on television. All I'm going to do is play video games. You don't do anything. Karl Barth defines sloth as perpetual busyness. So the perpetually, see, what's it, you see this still in America. What if you're a virtuous American, how do you prove you're virtuous? Work like, I don't have a moment in my schedule. I am booked solid. I don't, you know, for weeks and weeks, if you wanted to get an appointment with me. Now, Karl Barth said that's actually sloth. It's actually disguised laziness. Because what it means is I no longer have time. I have purposely blanked out all the most important things in the world, like prayer, meditation on the Word of God, a relationship with my wife and children, my friendships. Yes, of course, work is important, but I've now absolutized it, and curiously, it's a kind of laziness. Really interesting perspective. Now, I would want to go beyond Barth because we are ceasing to be a busy society as we are moving into our apparent decline. And I would say that the essence of original sin now, almost, if you will, the heart of liberal culture is, and you can, this is a several word phrase you hear echoed over and over and over now in advertisement after advertisement after advertisement. And it is, let's see if you can guess. It is the word you deserve. You got it exactly. I deserve this. I deserve that. I deserve health care. I deserve a wonderful retirement. I deserve a wonderful relationship. So I should, you know, whatever. We deserve everything. And what that is actually covering up is massive ingratitude. The whole essence of our culture is becoming one of complaining and ingratitude. And Paul himself in Romans chapter 1 defines sin He says they refuse to give thanks. So what I would say, we've reached the point where ingratitude is the very essence of original sin. How do you combat ingratitude? With gratitude, with thanks, thanksgiving, which, by the way, I think that is the very heart of the whole of the charismatic renewal. I don't think the heart of the charismatic renewal was glossolalia. The heart of the charismatic renewal was praise the Lord, was giving thanks, was gratitude, was a renewed emphasis in worship on thanking God for all things, including bad things, because God is behind all bad things to make them good. Not that bad things are good, but good things come out of bad things because of the grace and the mercy of God. So where I leave you today is our calling. How do we combat most effectively what is all around us? Gratitude. And this is another element of psalm singing. The psalms are made up of laments. The psalms are made up of requests for God to bring justice. But I suspect that the largest element of the whole of the Psalter is gratitude to God in the midst of all things. We want to combat what's going on all around us in our cities, everywhere. All of the terrible things that we see, including the gender issue, we combat it with gratitude. Gratitude and thanksgiving. That is truly countercultural, and that is truly powerful and overcoming. Thank you, and I've been very delighted to be here today and allowed to speak to you. Thanks.